Montana particularly, that nail down the ages more precisely, and it's more like 67. The extinction doesn't change, just the absolute age,
the age
of what it was.
Changes.
So that's the way
relating it
works.
To the cause also.
Right, because, well, I mean, again, because you're looking for, so when we tell time in a core, there's no time to go date it. What you do is you have paleontologists out with you at sea.
Exactly.
And they're actually going, oh, no, we're still in the Eocene because I still see this bug that didn't evolve yet. And, you know, oh, we've got to be in the early Eocene because I'm now starting to see, that no longer see a bug that I know evolved before. So I've been, you know, and then, oh, we've got to be getting close. I'm starting to see this particular, you know, right? And then, oh, they're gone.
Yeah, you know.
Right. So
that's great.
And that's the standard way of telling time.
Yes. Is there any scientific evidence that the Boltish crater or Silverpit crater either is, you know, chemically or whatever, another family of the same meteor impact?
Silverpit isn't even demonstrated to be a crater yet.
Maybe a slough thing. Or ejecta.
Boltish is potentially also a carbonation cone, right? So it might be from the same family. It is near in age. But if it's just one other, it could also just be, the problem is that we should actually have, you know, like the Nadir crater off of Africa that we just recently discovered, which also is not proven to be an impact yet. We should actually have one of those every million years or so. So, you know, how do you know that that particular, that matters?
300,000 years itself, you know, I mean, it's...
Well, but the problem is we just, our record is so incomplete, right? We should have an 8 or kilometer size.
Well, what does the chemistry say?
But if it's a carbonaceous chondrite, then... A lot of them are carbonaceous chondrites, right? Now, fingerprinting the chemistry back to an impact site, if it's ejecta, that's pretty easy to do.
Right? I spent 12 years in Ukraine, so I almost did an expedition of this.
Let me hear about sulfur.
No.
You always think about volcanoes and everything.
Right.
But you said that, you know, the impact created or found a lot of.
Just because it happened to hit. And hydrite and gypsum, which are just
evaporated ocean.
As you said, you know,
When you evaporate an ocean, you leave behind rocks. You know, eventually you might get halite. You get some of that. But you get, before you get halite, which is the, you know, you actually get a whole lot of the sulfur-rich salts. You end up, and then if you desiccate
it's from the salts, okay.
Yeah, and if you actually dry it out
enough, you
make something called anhydrite, which is a very hard, sulfur-rich rock, which is probably what we see in the geophysics, because it's bright reflection.
Was the iridium distributed pretty uniformly over the surface of the Earth?
So everywhere we have a preserved boundary layer that's really fully preserved.
The iridium itself came from the asteroid. From the asteroid. And
So people always ask, you know, did you find the asteroid in the crater? That's not how it works, right? They vaporize and they become, you know, globally distributed.
Yeah, so the actual contents of the asteroid went up fast, or
so it is in that center of
ejecta.
It's in the very, very center of that creation of the initial, and it's already vaporizing upon impact, right? So it's part of that ejecta, and it's part of some.
It's part of the ejecta.
Yeah, the center of that ejecta plume, and then the whole target. I mean, you can kind of think of streamlines moving through the target. So as it creates, so you can think of the particle pathways, and the ones nearest the center, including anything in the asteroid itself, are the ones that are going to be the highest velocity.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then as you move down and out, you're going to get longer travel paths and slower velocities. So, you know, much of the proximal ejecta is made of things that are, you know, kind of low and slow, right? And much of the initial asteroid is high and fast.
How high were the Appalachians then? And is there any evidence of the tidal ring, or, you know, the
I haven't heard of that in the Appalachians. They were somewhat inland on the east coast. So the Appalachians formed 300 million or so.
But they were much bigger then.
Well, absolutely. They were the Himalayan size.
I have to still ask because we deal with.
So, I mean, there's no, like, kind of ring from. You've ever been to Maui, Lanai, you have a bathtub ring at, like, 800 feet from the landslide. tsunami.
It's conceivable
off of
you could
island.
Find. I haven't heard of anybody finding one. Really, you know, all these things are needle in history. You've got to find
something
that happened exactly then. Like this discovery in the North Dakota site, you know, that just happened to be
that was one
location that was just deep enough.
It just
enough
seemed
to
they were it all happened in one day, the day that killed the dinosaurs.
Which is already a stretch because it's not a day, right?
It's a long time, but still. They must have been very.
This sulfuric acid which was in the atmosphere. Instead of it blocked sunlight.
Sulfate aerosols. Not sulfuric acid.
So the aerosols, wouldn't they also, in the troposphere, wouldn't it get hard to breathe?
Well, so if it's staying up in the stratosphere, right, then eventually raining down, it will eventually actually, rain out as. Probably something that causes a slight acidification. But it's not going to spend much time in the lower atmosphere, right? Because of the height that it was injected, it's going to be in the upper atmosphere until it starts to be removed entirely. And then it should go through the lower atmosphere.
Would it create lots of acid rain?
So there's an argument that it would have had that and the CO2 drawdown, right? Both would have had some. pH change, but if you look at, but not a lot necessarily, if you look at the proxies for how much we think the pH might have shifted, it wouldn't have been a huge change. It's actually a far bigger change to have a huge amounts of CO2 over time. That drawdown results in a much higher signature.
Birds have calcareous shells. I was thinking about that. They have brittle shells as opposed to lizards, which have these leathery shells. They're permeable.
Oh, in terms
bird
of
shells are not permeable to water.
That's right.
Lizard and snakes are permeable to water. As a matter of fact, they can suck water in. So I was wondering if something went wrong with the water, the ones with the soft shells would have difficulty.
Well, there's been discussions about not just the hardness of the egg, but also the egg-laying strategy as being one of the white reasons why some may have made it. You know, those that buried their eggs versus, those that intentionally put them out in an open spot. I mean, there's been a lot of debates about that. I don't know that we have really good evidence one way or the other, honestly, for that. It is interesting to think about lizard eggs versus bird eggs.
So if something like that hits something, even say something much smaller, say a mile diameter, right, hits the ground or the ocean where there isn't any carbon or sulfur, the entire global effects and planetary meteorological effects are much, much, much less.
Well, and actually, if you make it smaller, they're just much, much, much less. So part of it is just the volumetrics of what you're producing, right? So there's actually some really cool software to play with, something called the Earth Impacts Effects Database. Mm-hmm. It's just a website. You can just Google Earth Impacts Effects.
Oh, really?
Right, Earth and you could pick, Impact. You could play with the velocity, the size, what it is.
Oh, that's so neat. Kids love that.
And then say, how far away are you from the impactor? Thank you. And it will tell you, what you would have felt. Like, what wind speed, what earthquake arrival.
Google?
Yeah, just Google it on a, it's run out of Imperial College London. With help from Purdue.
That's very cool.
But it's a really neat little software. You can ask the question. And the thing you'll realize very quickly is it is not linear, right? As you going from 1 kilometer to 10 kilometer asteroid, the effects. Yeah.
But anything over about 4 miles is pretty fatal.
The maximum you could get.
Well, so, I mean, the maximum you can get ever, we have a great example of that, right? I mean, Mars-sized body hit us 10 million years in and made the moon.
Okay.
Right. So they get a whole lot bigger
about that. That's just,
That's really well presented.
You really think so?
Absolutely. That's super well supported now. It
just because the rocks are the same.
It's the partitioning of what the moon is relative to the Earth. What its magma ocean must have been relative to what our magma ocean must have been. The moon had to have come from Earth. It is not a separate chondritic. It doesn't look like another accreted body that we then captured. It is the same as us.
Why couldn't it have formed in situ, right next to Earth? Consolidation.
Mineralogically.
Why couldn't it have formed like right next to Earth?
Came from Earth.
As separate consolidation from similar material.
Because it's too similar. You know, we basically are the same thing. We had a parent body, that parent, but given the size, we are the parent body. But the only way to make something that size relative to us is to have a really large body have actually impacted us in general.
And so in that whole theory, how much was lost? 25%? 30%?
Oh, the size of the moon versus the size of the Earth.
I mean, just splashed out into space completely. You know,
no, it's
not
much smaller than that. It's 180.
Yeah.
180.
Yeah, I think that's right.
In terms of density, anyway.
Yeah.
The moon is kind of small. It's 2,000.
It's surprisingly big to be our moon, but it's actually quite small, right?
And you got a qubit to get the volume, which is what people do.
Yeah. You know, I went to Yucatan in 89, and it was like idyllic, you know, 3 months of scuba diving and seeing Mayan ruins, and I was all over the place, you know, in Merida. And after I came back, the whole news about Chicxulub, that I was right there. I was at the end of the world, and I would have dived on the spot, you know, even if they couldn't see anything, just to be on the spot where the dinosaur crater or, you know, meteor hit. Was it in the water?
It comes from a town called Chicxulpuerto. There's actually two towns. It's Chicxul Pueblo. Actually, Chicxul Pueblo is maybe the true center, but there's two towns next to each other.
Well,
one on the sea, one in the, you know, nearby. They're about 10 kilometers away from each other or something. But it's Chicxul Puerto and Chicxul Pueblo. And so that's roughly the geographic center of the whole. So that's why they named it Chicxul.
Was the impact in the water or on the land?
So it was all water at the time.
It's like 10 miles off or so.
No, it was all water at the time. It was totally ocean at the time. So the outer, to the northeast, the water depth was probably about 2 kilometers, and to the southwest it was at least 100 meters, maybe 200 meters. So it was at least shelf water depths, and it reached out.
Oh, so the land border wasn't there at all?
No. It was all water at the time.
I never seen the maps of that.
That's before it was the Ice Age.
No, that's it's partly just where the arrangement of the tectonic plates were at the time, but partly it's the local buildup that is the creation of limestone hadn't yet happened, right? So the sea level wasn't that different. It was a little higher than today, right? And there wasn't much ice on the planet, certainly. But most of the local topographic effect is then you made a basin, you filled it up, and then you grew a lot of that as limestone. So you end up with a flat, wide shelf, basically.